Hello and welcome to Filibustering History, a podcast series where we discuss what historians do with their lives. I am Rob Denning, lead faculty for the history programs at Southern New Hampshire University's College of Online and Continuing Education. At this point, I usually introduce my fellow traveler, my comrade in arms, the guy I go to for arcane punk rock knowledge, James Fennessy, but he's out doing something right now. And won't be joining us, so he's dead to us for this episode. Maybe he'll return next time, maybe not. So today it's just me interviewing Lorianne Deaver, an instructor in the history department at Southern New Hampshire University. Lorianne recently recorded a conversation with James and me about her research into the collapse of the Teton Dam in eastern Idaho in 1976, and the federal, state, and local responses to the disaster that came from that collapse. That conversation will appear as an episode of the History Soundbites podcast, but this conversation, the one you're listening to right now, is a behind-the-scenes talk with Lorianne about her research, her background, and what comes next. What is your name, and what do you do?
I am Lorianne Deaver, and I am a history instructor at SNHU.
Well, that's great. We're glad to have you. One of the reasons that we are talking to you is because of the presentation that you recorded for us on the collapse of the Grand Teton Dam and the response of the local LDS Mormon community to it. And just to provide people a sense of who you are and where you come from, can you give us a little bit of your academic and professional background?
Sure. I did my undergraduate work at a small liberal arts school in Virginia. And while I was there, I fought going into history for a long time because I didn't think it would be practical. Now I'm glad that I've moved away from that. But it was great to be in Virginia, and that's where I kind of fell in love with American history. It was a very small school when I went there, Southern Virginia University. And when I started, it was 250 students, and my high school graduating class was like 500, so it was weird. And I had a really great advisor, and he kind of took me under his wing, and just listening to his lectures was really amazing. And it was a small enough school that we would go on field trips in college. And we went to Jamestown and Williamsburg, several Civil War battle sites. And I think that kind of just got me more excited about it. I always felt growing up in Idaho that there wasn't a lot of history there. I have been proven wrong since then, but that was what got me excited. So I majored in history at SVU, and then I took several years off while my husband was finishing his degree and going on to other educational pursuits. And then we ended up back in Boise, and I applied to Boise State, and that's where I got my master's degree. And while I was there, I focused on environmental history, and I've really enjoyed that. It's been a perspective on American history that's really opened my eyes to all the different possibilities and avenues for looking at the American narrative differently. So that's kind of my educational background in a nutshell. And then while I was at Boise State, I was a graduate assistant, and I think I taught Western civilization probably about a billion times. And that would be my work background. And now I teach several different history classes at SNHU.
Yeah, your educational background sounds fairly similar to mine. I went to school in California, and the school I went to, California State University, Sacramento, their history program is heavily geared towards the study of the American West. And so my MA thesis was on California during Reconstruction. My dissertation, I eventually went to Ohio State for my PhD program, but while I was there, I stuck with California as my topic. Ended up going into environmental history and talking about the development of the environmental regulations in California in the 1960s, 1970s. And so a big part of that is talking about, you know, the history of water regulations and air regulations and attempts to clean up pollution. But another big part of it, of course, out in the West is the redistribution of water, because you've got finite amount of water, and you've got a whole lot of dry land out there. And so one of the biggest environmental questions, or the biggest environmental problems of the West, in addition to the usual things like smog and pollution and all of that, but also there's just the distribution of natural resources in order to maximize agriculture and other industries throughout the West. And so it's a fascinating history. I think it's amazingly fascinating anyway, so I'm glad to hear that you like that too.
We could probably sit here and talk for hours about the development of water reclamation projects and all that in the West. That's really cool. I'm glad you're excited about that because I am too.
I know, if you had told me 10 years ago that reading about pollution and water redistribution and all of these things would be something that I was interested in, I would have been shocked. And I think I'm still shocked that this is what I like, but I get into these different stories and it's just fascinating to me. I think one thing that I've liked about environmental history is looking at how pollution and those types of things tend to hurt different socioeconomic classes more seriously. And so one of the things that I've kind of looked at or really enjoyed studying was just the inequalities that come out with the use of the environment and this idea that people profiting from these companies don't live around where they're polluting. So it's the workers, and it's that tension between they need the job, but they're hurting themselves and the environment. And what do you do that gets me in a historical mode and interested and wanting to research? And I think that's what drove me into environmental history, but it was not something that I'd ever thought about. So it does surprise me on a daily basis that that's what I'm doing, but I love it.
There is something to be said for there's kind of been a theme of Western environmental history where the West is in kind of a colonial relationship with the more industrialized areas of the country because the West is there to extract raw resources, but they're not actually processing those resources in the West. They're always shipping it back to, the East Coast or into California or something where all these resources get processed into finished goods. And so there is kind of this sense of, in the old days, they would call it kind of a colonial relationship. I think we probably are a bit more nuanced about it now, but there is kind of that sense of how things operate in the West and just the remoteness of it, the sparse population. So it does create environmental concerns that are different from the rest of the country because, California is different because California is always kind of different from the rest of the West because of population and all of that. But so California's got concerns with like smog and all of that, but in other areas of the West, they don't really have too much of a problem with smog or the dirty water is caused by things like resource extraction rather than pollution, chemical pollution from industrial plants and all of that. So in some ways the problems are similar, but in other ways they are very different.
Yeah, definitely. It's a topic that I think there is a lot left to be said on, that's for sure.
And like you said, it's not exactly a sexy topic. I mean, when it comes right down to it, it's a hugely important topic, though, because a lot of these communities in the West simply would not exist without these environmental issues, because the environmental issues are caused because of these communities exist in the first place. A lot of communities in the West shouldn't exist where they are. They only do it through the manipulation of the natural environment. I always tell my students, I always kind of crack jokes with them about the city of Los Angeles should not exist in California. There's no water there. There's no reason it should be there. The only reason it exists is because Californians over the last, 150 years have rerouted all of the water systems for like the surrounding three, four states to send water to Los Angeles in order to keep it alive. And that's a conscious human decision. And so the environment, even if it's not something that seems completely obvious, it's one of those things where if not for the environment, the life would be very different, obviously. Well, I mean, that's kind of a given, I suppose, but it's something that we don't even think about. We don't think about the built environment that has helped us to reshape the environment through things like dams and canals and basically all the water redistribution processes that we've built throughout the West.
Yeah, I agree. It's definitely a heavily manipulated environment, but we don't tend to see it that way. And I think when we misunderstand that, that's where we start to have issues. That's what in Idaho, I know we debate a lot about protecting certain areas and things like that. And but you're always like, what are we protecting? A manipulated environment, and do we want it to go back to a natural state? All of these issues that if you don't look at it, you don't understand what the consequences are going to be. And so I know that's something that we debate in Idaho all the time. It's, one obvious example would be the introduction of wolves or reintroduction of wolves. There's two sides to every story, and you hear both sides of the argument, and it's a difficult issue. But that's, one representative issue that I think we keep debating in the West. Like, what do we want it to look like? Because we've manipulated it so much that I don't think we know. I don't think we really want it to go back to what it was.
No, right, because if we let it go back to the true environment that existed before humans lived here, then humans wouldn't be able to live here anymore because we don't have the right water in the right place and all of that. We only exist because of all the man-made changes to the environment. So yeah, basically we just have to pick which version of the man-made environment do we want to conserve and, maintain for future generations, because which creates a whole different thing because future generations are going to think, oh, this is like the natural West, when in reality, the natural West doesn't look anything like basically any version that we could preserve at this point without just getting up and leaving completely.
Yeah, definitely.
So this was the Teton Dam and the Mormon response was the topic of your MA thesis, correct?
Yes.
And are you thinking of kind of sticking with this? Are you going to conduct more further research into this topic, or do you think you may eventually move on to something else? Or what does the future hold for you?
So I am doing a panel on the Teton Dam for the Mormon History Association conference in June, which is actually in Boise. Works out great for me.
Nice.
And I've been working on trying to narrow it down into a presentation, which is kind of hard. And then I just got accepted to speak at another panel at the end of March, and I branched out into looking into the environment in the Civil War, which is what my mentor at Boise State, Lisa Brady, did. And she kind of wrote one of the bigger books about just the environmental destruction of the Civil War. And so I'm taking a little piece of that and looking at kind of the mental impact of the Union strategy of trying to destroy the Shenandoah Valley during late 1864. Historian Mark Neely has said if you look at the actual destruction and the records, it really wasn't this big burning that everybody talks about. They call it the burning of the Shenandoah. And he's like, this isn't true. And so for me, that was kind of interesting. I was like, why would everybody continue to refer to it as that? And so I'm looking at 19th century environmental ideals. And one of the things that I came across was that for them in the 19th century, a lot of people in the South would have seen a cultivated field, and that would have been their environmental ideal. Nature that is being used properly, nature that's being harnessed, subdued. And so to see
And
it turn
productive.
into a wilderness or, destroyed was something that got at their identity. And so I think that's why you see this discrepancy in what actually happened and then their perception of it. So I'm presenting that at the end of March at a conference for my mentor who taught at SVU for 21 years, and he's leaving. And so we all pick topics based on things that he's interested in. So I'm trying to combine my interest with the environmental side and his interest in the Civil War. It was fun to get into that. I didn't really want to touch the Civil War at all, ever. There's so many people who are experts, and so I was a little leery of it, but it was fun to get into something new and not dam related for a little bit.
Yeah, the Civil War is intimidating just because of the sheer volume of books that have been written. It's that seems to be one of the topics that feels like everything has been covered on it, but obviously there are different ways to go with it, and so I think you'll be fine with it. I think that's a really interesting topic. I haven't heard of much discussion of that aspect of the Shenandoah Valley. I like that you're combining kind of the environmental perspective with also the I don't know if you'd want to call it like a psycho history, but if you're talking about kind of the mentality of the people that involved, I think it's really interesting to look at it from that perspective. That seems like, to use the cliche, fertile ground.
Exactly. And they would have loved that cliche, so it
Yeah,
works.
exactly. Yeah, what can I say? All right, well, all of that sounds great. Do you have anything to recommend to us today?
Yeah, so I have a couple of books that I just finished, and I feel like they go together, so I'll just mention them in the same discussion. But the first one is The Half Has Never Been Told: Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism, and that's by Edward E. Baptist. And then the other one is The Other Slavery: The Uncovered Story of Indian Enslavement, and that's by Andres Resendez. I read these two books at about the same time, and the first one that I mentioned talks about American chattel slavery in a way that I had never put it all together. And so he says that he's going to talk about capitalism, and he shows just how dependent not just the American economy was, but if you look at all of our trading partners in the 19th century and even before. So we're looking at Europe in Africa. and how dependent all of those systems were on American slavery, we should really probably take a look at how we talk about slavery. And one of the things that really kind of changed my mind, and I hate to admit this, but I had always, in talking about slavery, said, oh no, it wasn't profitable. It was a very outmoded form of labor, and it hurt the Southern economy. And this author, Baptist, came out and said, no, actually, it was incredibly profitable. And he talks about all the different ways that he calls them enslavers. So the white masters would get labor out of their slaves, and shows that when we talk about it in this way, that it was profitable, then we get rid of the argument that, well, inevitably it would have died out. And so he shows the necessity of why we had to have the Civil War. And so, I mean, that was one of many insights that I got from the book. And I think it really kind of shattered some of the myths that even I, who I thought I'd read a lot about it, had apparently been carrying around. And then the other book that I mentioned, which was called The Other Slavery, looks at American Indian enslavement from the time of Columbus on. And I had no idea that because there were no laws about enslaving Native Americans, either for or against, and that there just wasn't this legal code that you found, like with African American slavery, that Native American slavery persisted into the early 20th century. And it looked different than African slavery, but the things that were going on around it, you have some of the same negative consequences and just kind of the heart-rending individual stories. But I felt like those two books kind of really changed the way that I will approach slavery in my classes in the future. I teach History 314, which is European Conquest of the New World, and we talk a little bit about Native American slavery, but I felt like now I'll have so much more to offer on the discussion board when that comes up, because there was just so much I didn't know. So that's my reading insights recently.
Yeah, those sound really good. I would like to check those out. I've encountered the general arguments behind those, but I haven't actually read the books yet, so I will put those on my list, my ever-growing, ever impossible to get through list. But yep, they'll be on there.
Yeah, I have one of those too.
Yeah. My recommendation is actually fairly, it's in the same vein. The Southern Poverty Law Center put out a new report at the end of January called Teaching Hard History, where they are talking about how we teach history at the grade school level. And what they found after conducting a bunch of surveys with school teachers is that, as you can imagine, there's a lot of kind of concern and trepidation around the study of history and around the teaching of history, especially when it involves slavery, because it brings up so many issues with race relations, and especially today with the aftermath of things like the kind of the resurgence of white supremacist movements in the United States recently. There's just kind of a general concern over what we can say about slavery without making people angry, and how do you do that in this kind of racially charged environment that we live in? And the general conclusions that the SPLC found is that high school and even below, but history teachers are concerned about that. They don't quite know how to teach history. And they don't really know what to say about history. And so what is happening is that students that go through those classes are coming out of it having a very shaky and skewed and a view of history that has a lot of gaps in it. And so they're finding things like history students are unable to name slavery as, the primary cause of the Civil War. I mean, we don't need to get into a debate over the states' rights versus slavery and all of that, but from a mainstream historical perspective, slavery is at the root of the Civil War. But a lot of students don't know that, and they can't say that, or they can't formulate it. And so teachers are teaching about slavery, but they're not very going into too much detail about it. Textbooks aren't providing very good coverage of slavery. They tend to speak in generalities. Whenever we talk about slavery, we tend to try to balance it. We try to talk about the good stuff like Harriet Tubman and the Underground Railroad at the same time that we're talking about the bad stuff, which tends to present to a lot of audiences that there's an equivalency there and there's a balance there, when in reality, you can't mitigate slavery by talking about the Underground Railroad. The Underground Railroad exists because slavery is such a horrible thing. So this report is trying to lay out the problems that teachers are encountering and why teachers are encountering these problems. Some of it is that, American history, we tend to like to talk about problems that we think are solved. So we like to talk about, oh, things happened in the past. They were miserable, but things are better now. We fixed it. And so race tends to get presented in that way. Slavery had slavery, but oh, look at all the great stuff we've done since then. There was a whole civil rights movement with Martin Luther King and all of that that fixed it. And so now we can move on and talk about other things. And so there's an unwillingness among history teachers to go into much more detail than that. And maybe not even an unwillingness, but they're just not sure how to do it without alienating audiences and all of that. And so this report is trying to come up with potential solutions to all of that. And those potential solutions are things like using primary sources that show what life was really like for slaves. We need to improve textbooks. We need to strengthen the curriculums. We need to provide resources to teachers to give them the context that they can use. That way that if they receive a challenge from a student or a parent or somebody, that they have something that they can fall back on and they can say, well, this is what the mainstream historical consensus is. But because we haven't really addressed it head on in a way for history teachers to be able to fall back on it, teachers feel like they're kind of left on their own, and that can create some tension and all of that. So anyway, I will post a link to the Southern Poverty Law Center report in the episode notes here, and we'll post links to the books that you mentioned a few minutes ago.
Great, yeah, I'll have to check that article out. It sounds really interesting, and that's something I've been thinking about too. It's hard to know how to approach the subject, and so to know that somebody is making an effort to at least open a line of discussion, I think is a great way to start.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Lorianne, for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks, Rob.
And thank you all for joining us today. If you have any questions or comments on this podcast or suggestions for future episodes, as always, send me an email at snhuhistory@gmail.com. For the AWOL, James Fennessy, and Lorianne Deaver, I'm Rob Denning. Bye-bye.